The Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to expanding human welfare through economic growth, on the web at kauffman.org.
Hi, I'm Donda Beard at WILL, and I want to let you know about a new way to make a charitable gift. Recently, Congress made changes to the Pension Protection Act of 2006, giving people age 70 and a half and older special tax incentives to make charitable contributions. For a limited period of time, you can make gifts to WILL of principal or income from your IRA account without paying tax, fulfilling your required minimum distribution, and receiving a charitable deduction on your tax bill. Such a savings may allow you to make a gift larger than you ever dreamed possible. Call me at 217-333-9393 or speak with your banker or tax professional for more information and more ideas on how to make gifts and save taxes.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. Support for today's broadcast comes from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS, presenting the host of This American Life, Ira Glass, in an evening entitled Radio Stories and Other Stories on Saturday, December 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets are now on sale at 217-206-6160 or online at sangamonauditorium.org.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Well, legislation designed to give the economy a boost passed earlier this year, and it included a number of tax breaks for certain folks, home buyers, homeowners, businesses, and real estate investors. Today, two tax experts join us to talk about the changes and year-end tax planning, as well as what might lie ahead in 2009 in terms of tax policy. Our guests are Marty Verdick and John Breen. Marty Verdick is a CPA and Managing Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey, and John Breen is a Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey, Incorporated. Listeners, if you have questions, give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Your questions about taxes and tax liability are invited this afternoon. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Good afternoon. Good to see you again. Thank you so much
for joining
us.
Good afternoon. It's always good to be here.
John, good to see you as
well.
You too. So how significant are the changes to tax law that came about as the result of the economic downturn, the credit crisis, the housing crisis, and so on and so forth?
Well, for some people, it can be quite significant. There are a number of changes, many of which are designed to encourage home buyers, to encourage spending money, to stimulate the economy. There are pieces of legislation that even now are pending that might affect people going forward. There's certainly some year-end planning opportunities with the downturn in the market. But just talking about the Housing and Economic Recovery Act, for example, which is one of the bills which passed this past year. It was in August, I believe, is when that passed. It has a number of things that are designed to help taxpayers, one of which is a first-time home buyer tax credit. And this is a credit, it is a what's called a refundable tax credit, meaning that even if it exceeds your tax liability, you would be entitled to receive that refund. Unlike some tax credits, which are limited to the amount of tax that you owe for that year, this is one that you would actually get back. And it's up to $7,500 of tax credit that would be available in the case of a joint return for qualifying taxpayers, and that would be a taxpayer joint return with income under $150,000 or a single taxpayer under $75,000. It does require that homes are purchased after April 9th of 2008 and before July 1st of 2009. So it's a relatively short window of opportunity mm-hmm. here. But what's interesting about this, unlike most credits, which when you receive a tax credit, it's yours. It's yours to keep. That's it. This is a credit that actually has to be repaid by the taxpayers who take advantage of it over a 15-year period. So it's not a giveaway. It's not free money. It's a free loan, essentially. So if a taxpayer who qualifies and takes advantage of this credit would get up to $7,500 in the year of the purchase to help with the cost of purchasing the home. But then over the next 15 years, they're going to be paying that back. And that starts 2 years after the home purchase. So you do get a couple of years mm-hmm. to get your feet on the ground, mm-hmm. but then you start paying it back with your tax return. So that's for taxpayers who qualify, $7,500 is a big deal.
It sure is.
And it is for first-time home buyers.
And also, given that the prices of homes have fallen significantly and mortgage rates are pretty attractive, this helps out a lot.
It does. It does. And it's something that was clearly targeted at the real estate market as a way of trying to spur the recovery in the housing market, which in some parts of the country are in much, much worse condition than we are here in central Illinois.
Yeah. Did the Housing and Economic Recovery Act provide anything else for taxpayers?
Well, one other item that is brand new this year is a property tax deduction if you don't itemize your deductions. In years past, the only way that you could claim property taxes on your house was if you itemized. And what the new tax act is basically going to do is it's going to increase the standard deduction by people who take advantage of this by either $500 if you're single or $1,000 if married filing joint. You know, even though your property taxes are going to be much larger than that in most cases, you still will be able to claim an additional standard deduction for up to $1,000 not available before.
Okay. Now, is that effective for this year and going forward, or has it got a limited time?
2008 only. Yeah.
2008
yep.
only.
So okay. Unless it's extended, it's one and done. You get it in 08. Of course, they have to pay for these things somehow. Although right now, based upon some of the activity in Washington, you might not think we have to really pay for anything. But in the tax area, there's usually an attempt to generate revenue to offset these kinds of things. So one of the ways that they've done that is they've created a reduction in the home sale exclusion. The rule previously was that if you met certain qualifications, up to $500,000 of gain on a joint return, gain from the sale of your principal residence is excluded from tax. And that was even true if the home had been used for business at some point in the past. Let's say that you operated a business out of the home and you were depreciating a portion of the home as an office and home. If it wasn't a business use at the time of the sale, you could exclude that gain as well. Now what the rule says is that if you convert a business asset into a personal residence. So let's say it was a rental property, you convert it into your principal residence and use it for a number of years and then sell it, the gain exclusion will be prorated based upon that relationship of business use versus qualifying period. So for some taxpayers, this will cost them potentially quite a bit of additional tax. And that's one of the revenue raisers to offset this first-time home buyer credit and this property tax deduction.
Okay. Was there any tax relief provided by Congress for those who lost their homes to foreclosure this year?
I'm going from memory. There was a provision, and I don't recall if it was enacted, but there was discussion of a provision that would eliminate what might otherwise have been gain as a result of the relief of indebtedness. Normally, if you have a debt that you don't have to pay, mm-hmm. You turn over your home and you have a debt that goes away, that can be triggered. That can trigger taxable income. And I remember seeing something, and I haven't looked at this in any detail yet. John's taking a quick look here. I thought I remembered seeing something on exactly that topic that would provide relief for those taxpayers.
Mm. Yeah, actually there is. It was part of the mortgage debt relief bill that was passed. And what they're talking about is being able to exclude from income up to $2 million of mortgage debt forgiveness on a principal residence. Now, there's some other qualifications that they, go into here as far as, who's going to qualify for that and so forth. But certainly there are going to be instances where you can have forgiveness of debt and not have to recognize income.
There have been a lot of very quick bills. Normally, legislation takes quite a while to move through Congress. But this year, there have been a lot of things that seem to go from start to finish in a very short period of time. Also, in the past, they've combined a lot of these tax things into one major tax bill, where this year, I mean, I made reference to the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008. The thing that John just referenced, what was that bill
called? That's the Mortgage Debt Relief Bill.
Yeah.
And then we also have the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act.
Exactly. And each one of these, in addition to a lot of non-tax provisions, they build in some little tax things here and there. There's also a lot of relief that was granted for those taxpayers who happen to reside in areas that were affected by a lot of the floods. For example, in Iowa, most of the state of Iowa was declared a federal disaster area as a result of the floods of this past summer, and there's been legislation that's been passed to provide relief, tax relief for those folks as well. So lots and lots of relatively, I would call them small tax bills with a few tax provisions that have come through in the last 6 months.
Tax liability and year-end tax planning are topics this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guests are two tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated. They are Marty Verdick and John Breen, and they have joined us over the years, generally a couple of times during the year as we approach April 15th, and they are here with us this afternoon to take your calls. If you've got a question about year-end tax planning, what you can do here at the end of the year to reduce your tax liability, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, what can we do here on the 12th of December as we head toward the end of the year in order to reduce our tax liability?
Well, one of the things that we're visiting with our clients about, and I would encourage everyone to look at, is we're in a unique situation where virtually everyone who has investments that are in the equity markets, mutual funds, individual stocks, have seen a significant decline in value, and in many cases have what are called unrealized losses. In other words, the value of that stock or mutual fund today is less than what they paid for it. Unfortunately, what's going to happen with many of these mutual funds is that they continue to produce capital gain distributions, and those are based upon internal trading activity within the mutual fund. So many people are going to find themselves in a situation where they have what may be a significant capital gain distribution on their mutual fund, while at the same time that mutual fund has gone down in value fairly significantly. And taxpayers said, well, how can that be? I mean, how can I have this capital gain? And remember, the capital gains distributions are triggered based upon sales of assets inside the fund. So one of the things that taxpayers should be doing right now is looking at any potential realized gains, such as mutual fund distributions or other sales, and then looking at what opportunity they might have to do what's called harvesting losses. In other words, if you've got stocks that have gone down in value or mutual fund shares that have gone down in value, you may want to consider selling those before the end of the year to get those capital losses in this year. A taxpayer is allowed to use capital losses to offset capital gains on a dollar-for-dollar basis. Plus, they can use up to $3,000 of capital losses to offset ordinary income. So if a taxpayer has, let's say, $10,000 of capital gain distributions from a mutual fund, they might want to consider harvesting, $10,000 to $15,000 in capital losses to offset those gains plus up to $3,000 against ordinary income. May want to do more than that, because any excess losses carry forward. Now, there is a provision known as the WASH sale rule, W-A-S-H, that says that you can't sell a stock or a security and buy substantially the same investment within a 30-day period and claim the loss. So if a taxpayer is going to sell, let's say, some shares in a mutual fund and they want to stay in the market, they can't just sell shares of that mutual fund and buy shares back in that mutual fund or a substantially identical fund. So if they're in a, let's say, an S&P index fund, they might need to buy shares or might consider buying shares in like a Russell 1000, something that is a similar index but not substantially the same. If they buy into the same investment within a 30-day period, that loss wouldn't be allowed. But what we don't want to have happen would be for taxpayers to have large capital gains that they recognize this year and have to pay tax on, and then have all of these capital losses sitting out there that they could have recognized and didn't. And they have, another 3 weeks or so, less than 3 weeks before the end of the year to get that taken care of.
Okay. Let's take a call. Okay. Listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon. Caller in Urbana, line one. I think they have rung off, as they say. We'll encourage them to call back. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guests this afternoon, Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, what about what are the rules now as of the moment for putting money into retirement savings vehicles? That's another way to reduce your liability, correct?
Yeah, actually, most of those rules have really not changed. One thing regarding kind of retirement distributions that is kind of a hot button because we've been receiving several calls on it at the office, is there's some legislation right now in Congress that would allow those people who are over 70 and a half that are required to take distributions out of their retirement plans, specifically their IRAs, to be able to delay that in 2009. Everything that we've read so far says that it's not going to impact us for 08, but you know, part of this is to let our seniors not have to dip into, you know, their retirement savings at a period where the investments are down. So that is one thing that, you know, we've had a lot of phone calls on, and unfortunately what happens is whenever they're talking about it in Congress, a lot of people believe it's already the law. So we're still waiting to see whether or not that's going to get signed, you know, probably within the next few weeks.
Okay. Has it passed both houses?
I believe it has passed the houses. I think the current status is it's waiting for the president's signature.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be effective, at least currently, as it's currently drafted, it wouldn't be effective until 2009. So it's not going to provide relief for people who are sitting there needing to take a distribution before the end of the year. And the reason this is such a big issue, as John mentioned, is that values are down. The required minimum distribution calculation is based upon the value of the retirement plan, the IRA or the 401k plan, as of the first day of the year. So the minimum distribution calculation is based upon an account value which was significantly higher than it is today. And it would be essentially what the rules are as they are written without this change. It's forcing people who are required to take these minimum distributions, those over age 70 and a half, to liquidate assets at a time when the values are hopefully at or near their lowest levels and maybe going back up. Unfortunately, this particular piece of legislation wouldn't provide relief until 2009. It's not going to help the people who are in that situation between now and the end of the year unless something changes.
Yeah. How much pain this apparently is causing some people, some grief, some pain?
Well, based upon the number of phone calls we're getting, it is, because John and I have both had a number of calls on this particular issue, and people are saying, gee, I really don't want to take the money out right now because who wants to sell their GM stock when it's trading at, you know,
nothing.
Mm-hmm. So there are people who are they would prefer to leave the money in, but they're just not being permitted to based upon the minimum distribution rules. So it's out there. It's something that's being discussed right now. I printed something off of one of the websites on actually yesterday where they were talking about it. So this is something that is very, very current. We haven't actually seen the legislation yet. We're just seeing kind of narratives of what would happen.
Yeah. Speaking of legislation that's going to be drafted, let's say, we were looking ahead to the next administration, a new Congress. What might we expect to see regarding tax policy with the inauguration of the 44th president and the new Congress when it's sworn in?
Well, if we were doing this a month ago, if we'd been sitting here a month ago, I think John and I would agree that we would have been saying that there is a very high likelihood that we'd be looking at some tax increases for people in higher income levels, probably in the $200,000 to $250,000 range, probably looking at an elimination of the 15% rate of tax on dividends and the 15% rate of tax on capital gains. However, the more current discussions going on among the transition team in Obama's camp is that it seems likely that there may be a deferral of tax increases because they recognize that raising taxes in difficult economic times would not contribute toward the economic recovery. So what we're hearing now, and John, you might want to comment on this. You were in a meeting about a week ago where this was discussed. It seems likely that rather than seeing an immediate increase, several of the things like the 15% rate of tax on dividends and capital gains, which is scheduled to expire at the end of 2010, might just be allowed to die on its own as opposed to accelerating the tax increase on that. Those provisions are designed to what's called sunset or end as of December 31st, 2010, and it seems likely that will happen. I think long term we're looking at tax increases. I think we're probably looking at the top tax bracket going back up to 39.6% from the 35% rate. John, you want to comment on anything else that you guys discussed in that meeting?
Well, that was really kind of the gist of the update that we had. I think that, as Marty said, you know, if you had asked us a month or two ago, I think our strategy with our clients was to say, well, hey, we know what the rate is in 2008 as far as capital gains. So if you were contemplating sales, we probably would have maybe encouraged people to do that a little bit more than we might today. Because everything that we're hearing says, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, in 2009 they won't change, and also a fairly good chance that they'll just be allowed to expire at their normal rate. So I really think that some of the sense of urgency from that perspective, has leveled off.
Yeah. I had clients that were trying to accelerate transactions based upon the expectation that capital gains rates were going to go up. They were attempting to sell some real property and doing a lot of things, including offering some fairly good incentives to a buyer to close the deal this year. And they've backed off on that because this sense of urgency, I think, has gone away a little bit. I mean, normally when we're sitting here in December talking about tax planning, we're talking about the typical strategy of accelerating deductions and deferring income. And this year has been a bit unusual with the expectation of the higher rates possibly coming. There have been a lot of clients who have been doing things to accelerate income, especially certain types of income, capital gains and qualifying dividends. We've had some closely held corporations who have decided to pay out fairly significant dividends to their owners this year to get that 15% rate of tax on qualifying dividends that may not be there next year or at some point in the future. I think today we're probably more likely to say that the rates aren't going to go up as quickly as we all thought they might. I think long term we're probably still looking at rate increases because let's face it, all of these bailout packages in Washington have to be paid for somehow, and ultimately we know who pays for that.
Yeah, well, the bill's going to come due one day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. This afternoon, our guests are Marty Burdick and John Breen. They are both with RSM McGladrey Incorporated. Listeners, if you've got a question about your taxes, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, one of the things it seems to me that whenever the two of you are on, we talk about the AMT.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been another patch? And what's the outlook for getting that thing all sorted out?
Well,
will that ever happen or just patch, patch, patch?
Well, the short answer is yes and no. Yes, there has been another patch. Will it ever get sorted out? No. But let's expand on that a little bit. When we talk about the AMT, it's the alternative minimum tax, and it is as the name implies, it is an alternative way of calculating an individual's tax liability. And under this alternative minimum tax, a taxpayer pays the higher of their regular tax calculation or the alternative minimum tax. there are a number of things that can trigger alternative minimum tax, but it's not doing what it was designed to do originally. The tax was designed to assess a tax on taxpayers who were using perceived loopholes in the tax law to avoid paying tax. Because of inflation and people's incomes rising through inflation, this tax is now impacting far, far more taxpayers than was ever intended. Things like the exemption amount has not been indexed for inflation. So each year, Congress recognizes that this is a problem. And for the last several years, they have passed a patch or a one-year temporary fix to solve the problem. And as an example, I was doing a projection for a taxpayer last week, and I ran it using the old calculation and then ran it using the new calculation with this patch, and it made almost a $9,000 difference in their tax liability. And this is not someone who – I'm sure if you ask them if they perceive themselves as A, being very, very wealthy, or B, taking advantage of tax loopholes, they would answer no to both questions. And it made a $9,000 difference. So for the taxpayers that are impacted by AMT, these patches are a very big deal. The reason that we're not seeing a permanent fix is that it's expensive. In the budgeting process in Washington, when they make a permanent fix, they have to come up with a way of paying for it. And because it is so expensive, they haven't come up with a way to pay for it. In addition to the patch with the exemption amount, there have been a few other changes in AMT, probably the most important of which is the incentive stock option preference item.
Okay. Well, we might be able to come back to that in a minute, but we've got a number of calls coming in
now. Let's take them.
Let's take them. First, we go to a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, we live here in Urbana. My son had a summer job in a different state, and the employer took out state income tax for that state, but not Illinois. How do we handle that?
Well, what's going to happen in that scenario is more than likely you will have to file a return with that particular state as a non-resident. And then what happens on the Illinois return is that you will get a credit for some piece of that tax that you're going to pay to the other state. It's not always a dollar-for-dollar credit because there's actually some calculations that you do on an Illinois Schedule CR. And for instance, if you're paying tax at a 6% rate in the other state and your tax here in Illinois is 3%, they're not going to give you credit for the 6% level. But you will get a credit in Illinois for the appropriate rate of tax that's equal to what you're paying in Illinois on that same income.
This is a very common problem, especially with students who might be attending college in another state and they get a part-time job. It does create an unfortunate situation where they may have to file a return in more than one state, and it's a bit of a burden. But this, as far as the state is concerned, you know, if the money was made in, let's say, the state of Ohio while they're attending school there, they want to collect tax on that money that was made in the state of Ohio. And then this credit that John mentioned is used to eliminate any double tax that you might have to pay on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Next, we go to Arlington Heights, a listener on line four. Hello.
Hello. Oh, I have a question that I hope you can help me with. It involves an IRA that belonged to my mother-in-law and was in distribution. Mm-hmm. She passed away. My husband got it.
Mm-hmm.
He took distributions as the beneficiary on his mother's IRA. My husband passed away a few years ago. And I was told one year by the IRS that I don't have to take a distribution. I'm not 70 and a half. And the question seems to pop up every year. And the brokerage account that has it is telling me that I should be taking
this
distribution. So it's, just to reiterate, it's my mother-in-law's IRA that was in distribution. My husband got it after she died, and then I got it after he died.
Please help.
Well, first of all, I can understand why you are getting conflicting answers, because the IRA distribution rules in the case of a decedent and a successor in interest or a beneficiary stepping into their shoes, those rules are very complicated and are very fact-specific, depending upon whether or not a person was in distribution mode, what the age of the beneficiary, the subsequent beneficiary is, and so on. I unfortunately am not going to be able to answer that question off the top of my head, but if you would like to contact me at the office, we have someone, one of our estate and trust specialists, who is very, very familiar with those rules, and we can give you an answer. I just can't I don't know it off the top of my head. John's taking a look at some reference material that we brought along, but I'm not sure that he's going to find an answer, because it is especially in your situation where you've had two layers of successive beneficiaries, the answer could be fairly complicated. Let me ask one question. When your husband, before your husband passed away, when his mother passed away, was he, what was his age at that point? Was he over age 70 and a half?
No, he wasn't.
Okay,
he was,
all right.
He was under, he passed away at the age of 64.
Okay.
The key thing, what I had been told was that the fact that my mother-in-law was receiving money from this thing was a critical factor.
That is exactly right. If the decedent was in distribution mode, in other words, if they had attained age 70 and a half and were required to begin receiving distributions, then that had an impact on what the successive beneficiary needed to do. Now, the thing that makes it a little bit unusual here is that your husband was in distribution mode only because his mother was at the time that he inherited it. What I'm not sure is whether that sort of artificial distribution mode that applied to him carries through to you.
Well, the IRS summed it up rather paradoxically on one go-round, and it seemed to have something to do with, when is your husband not your husband?
Yeah. Well,
I asked him to repeat that because it was, the answers were just getting screwier and screwier.
Well, I would first of all caution you to take any answer you get from the IRS over their toll-free number with some degree of I don't want to say skepticism, but certainly cautious trust, maybe, because it, especially with a question like this, which is a fairly unique situation. But if you are interested and would like to just contact us in the office, I will have you speak with the estate and trust person, and she will be able to answer that question.
Would you repeat the number for your office at some time during the program?
Sure, I'll give it to you right now. You could reach us at 217-398-9400.
Thank you.
And if you ask for either John or myself, we'll get the right person in touch with you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Yes. I'm going to be receiving the proceeds of an inheritance in about the mid-$80,000 range, and I'd like to distribute it to a couple of my siblings. I know I can do $12,000 a year, you know, each year. Would it be an advantage to write a check ahead of time before I receive it for the first distribution?
Well, first of all, let me address the kind of the fact pattern. You're receiving the inheritance, but what you would like to do is to share that with some siblings.
Yes.
Okay. You're exactly right that any amount that you receive that you distribute to your siblings through your generosity, not through the inheritance, is treated as a gift, and that gift is limited to a $12,000 per year annual exclusion amount. Any amount over that would result in the need for filing a gift tax return and the possible use of part of what's called your unified credit. Now, are you currently married?
No.
Okay. Because the reason I ask is that the $12,000 per year annual exclusion is a per year per person amount. So if you were married, you and your wife could each give $12,000 or a total of $24,000 per year. If the siblings are married, that same rule would apply. You could give $12,000 to your sibling and to their spouses. But absent that, if it's just individuals all the way around, you could, if you wanted to accelerate the gift as much as possible, even though you haven't received the $80,000 inheritance yet, you could give a $12,000 gift this year. and a $12,000 gift shortly after the first of the year, for a total of $24,000 per person, if you would like to do that. That $12,000 annual exclusion amount resets each year on January 1st. And if you don't use it in 1 year, it's gone. You can't carry it over. So if for example, you would like to give, let's say, $20,000 apiece to each of your siblings, you could give $10,000 now and $10,000 in a couple of weeks after the first of the year and get them that $20,000 very quickly. If you wait until January to give them the first installment, the first portion of that $20,000, you would then have to wait an entire year before you could give them the second portion of that.
Okay, and I know they don't have to show it as income.
Correct.
But do I have to show anything on my return as a gift?
No. That it is not taxable income to them, nor is it deductible by you. It is not reported by either party anywhere on their individual income tax return.
Okay, and I have one more question. Mm-hmm. My income varies a lot year to year. Is there any way I could income average this?
Well, first of all, when you say income average,
I mean the $80,000.
Well, that's a good question because the $80,000 is not taxable to you.
Okay, even though it's cash proceeds, it is not taxable.
Correct. As a inheritance, it is not taxable. So whether it's $80,000 or $800,000, it is not a taxable event to you. The only possible taxable portion would be. If the estate has been holding these funds for some period of time and has earned a little bit of money on it, that earnings amount could be taxable to you. But the principal itself, the $80,000 of principal, is not taxable to you. It does not need to be reflected anywhere on your tax return.
So I don't have to show it on my tax return at all then?
That's correct.
Okay, well, I think that answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you, then.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We're talking about taxes this afternoon. If you've got a tax question, give us a call, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good anywhere you're listening, 800-222-9455. Our guests this afternoon, two tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated. They are Marty Verdick and John Breen. What if your gift giving is not of cash but of stocks or property? Is it a similar kind of a situation, or is it a different tax situation?
Are you talking about charitable giving or gifts to individuals?
Gifts to individuals.
Okay. In the case of a gift to an individual, whether it's cash or property, the same $12,000 rule applies.
Okay.
The only thing that's a little bit unique about property is that there is what is known as carryover basis. And the best way I could illustrate this is with an example. Let's say that I have a stock that is worth $10,000 today that I'd like to give to my child. And let's say that I purchased that stock a long time ago for $1,000. If I sell that stock, I would have a $9,000 capital gain. If I give that stock away, mm-hmm. not as a charitable contribution, but give it to an individual such as a child, the value of the gift for gift purposes is $10,000. But my basis in that stock of $1,000 carries over to the recipient, and if they sell the stock, they would pay the tax on the $9,000. Somebody's going to pay tax on that. So that's the only thing that's unique about gifts of property to non-charitable organizations. Now, in the case of a charitable organization, you get a charitable deduction equal to the full fair market value of the property that you gave, and the charity would be the one to sell it. And charities are tax exempt, and so nobody pays tax on the gain. And that's a very good planning technique for individuals with appreciated assets, things that maybe you've got a piece of property that's gone up in value, or some stock that you've owned for a long time, so it's gone up in value, and so on. So that's something that we encourage people who make significant charitable gifts to consider, because it's just a lot more tax efficient than using cash.
Okay. And also, I have a little piece of information here that the IRS this year has a deal where you can donate for disaster relief in the Midwest and receive that's fully deductible up to 100% of AGI. Adjusted gross income.
Exactly. Normally, a charitable contribution is limited to either 30% or 50% of adjusted gross income. If it is a contribution of cash or cash equivalent, in other words, you write a check, you can deduct up to 50% of your adjusted gross income. If it is a gift of appreciated property, such as a stock gift that I was just using as an example, you would be limited to 30% of your adjusted gross income. This is a provision that would allow for a contribution deduction of up to 100% of adjusted gross income for certain qualifying gifts to charitable organizations in disaster areas. And this actually, I think they started this with Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
And they've done this with a number of other disasters to encourage charitable giving. Now, you know, I don't know too many people that are inclined to make a charitable contribution equal to or greater than 100% of their income. I've had a few clients do it, but it's pretty unusual. So, you know, these kinds of provisions sound really good, but in practice, there's not a lot of application for it in many, many cases.
Don't amount to a hill of beans,
right,
as my grandmother used to say.
You know, one thing that people need to remember as we're talking about charitable contributions, many employers have matching programs, and it's something that if a person wants to benefit a particular charity, they should check with their employer to see if there might be some type of matching program available. It may be a dollar for dollar match. It may be something a little different. I know in our case, our firm has many, many offices in Iowa, and we had many of our people and our offices were directly affected. Our Cedar Rapids office still is not open as a result of the flood. They're working in temporary quarters, I believe. And our firm did a program that they encouraged our employees to make contributions to, like a community foundation in Cedar Rapids for the benefit of the community. And any money that was raised, there was a match that the company put with it just to encourage our people to help our other people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all part of one company, and we have a lot of offices in Iowa that were affected. So as people are considering charitable contributions, they should look into the possibility of employer matches and not leave that money on the table.
Yeah, I know people giving to the Friends of WILL,
mm-hmm.
That's quite a list of firms
right.
that will match dollar for dollar their gift,
right.
which is a great deal.
Yep.
So when we're raising money, which we're
always
trying
raising
to
money.
Do,
yeah.
We always say to people, check it out.
I do wonder with the downturn in the economy, I wonder how many companies are going to continue those generous plans, but take advantage of them while you can.
Yeah, we keep our fingers crossed.
Absolutely.
Okay. Another question I have about what might lie ahead in 2009 as we have a new administration and a new Congress. There's been a fair amount of talk about a public works stimulus package. And one of the priorities of the incoming president has been the environment and energy policy. Do you think we'll see some green stimulus? Do you think part of that green stimulus might be in the form of tax policy?
Yes, and I'll comment on it, John,
and
if you want to jump
briefly,
in here.
And then we've got one more call.
Exactly. There are already a number of tax provisions designed to encourage energy conservation. For example, if you construct a facility and put in high energy efficiency lighting, there's some specific tax credits. Tax law is frequently used as a way of encouraging certain types of behavior. So I believe, yes, we absolutely will see some tax credits and some tax incentives for energy efficient consumption encouragement, whether it's in building construction, whether it's putting in more energy efficient heating and cooling units, more lighting efficiency, things like that. We already have some things, and I'm confident we're going to see more of it.
Okay, let's take a last call this afternoon. River Woods, line 4. Hi.
Hi there. I know you're running out of time, so I'll keep this quick. My father-in-law, he actually owns a small machining business, and he recently purchased a mid-sized truck, which he uses for both personal and business purposes. Can something like that be deducted from his business income?
Well, with the mid-sized truck, I mean, there's several different parameters that have to be met from the standpoint of you have to look at what's the gross vehicle weight. You also have to kind of compare, is it better to depreciate that vehicle versus take a mileage deduction? There's several different parameters that would be associated with that. I mean, the short answer would be that, yes, the business percentage of that vehicle is going to be able to be deducted. It's just a question of what's the best way to do it?
Once the vehicle is over 6,000 pounds of gross vehicle weight, some of the limitations that normally apply to depreciation on a vehicle go away. So the answer is yes, there are some tax benefits available there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. You're very welcome. And there we'll wrap things up. Thank you very much for joining us again today. And maybe we'll see you one more time before April 15th rolls around.
Sure. Would love to come back. It seems like kind of that third week in March is always a popular time. It's people are starting to work on their tax returns and they have questions.
Yeah. Okay.
Very happy to come back.
Okay. Our thanks this afternoon to Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. Marty is a CPA and managing director, tax services for RSM McGladrey. John is a director, tax services for RSM McGladrey. It is 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here with all the numbers, Todd Gleason.
It's about 60.
Let's try that again. And it's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers. I'm sorry, I had something else potted up in here. That means that it was on, and I wasn't paying attention to that actually running. So here are the numbers as they settled in Chicago. On this Friday afternoon, we'll start in the wheat pit for the day. Soft red winter wheat finished the nearby December contract at 506¾, up 15½ on the afternoon. The high at 508, the low at 476. Settlement price at 506¾, up 15½ cents for the December wheat. The March at 532½ for the high, the low at 489. Settlement price at 513, up 5½ on the May. 545 the high, the low at 502¼. Settlement price at 526, up 5¼. July 557¼, the high, the low at 515. Settlement price at $5.38¾, up 5¼. And next year's December, 597¼, the high, the low at 559¼. Settlement price for the December wheat, 2009, at 579¾, up 4¾ on the afternoon. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby contract 365, the high, the low at 325. Settlement price for the December 359½, up 21½ cents today. March futures 379½, the high, the low at 37. Settlement price at 373½, up 22. And the May at 390½, top. Bottom at 348, settled at 384¾, up 22¼. July futures from the corn pit 401, the high, the low at 357¾, settled 395¼, up 22¼. And December futures 425¾, top, bottom at 381¼, settlement price there at 420, up 23½. That July contract actually up 22½, not 22¼. December oat futures $1.99, a settlement price up 2½. The March at 213½, up 4 for the day. Soy complex. Now here's where some of the red came in for the day. January futures 864, the high, the low at 828. Settlement price close to the top, but still a loss for the day. 854, down 2½ cents for the January beans. The March at 866¾ on the high, the low at 30. Settlement price at 856¼, down 4¼. And the May beans, 875¼, the high, the low at 39. Settlement price at $8.65¾, down 4¼. July futures 885, the high, the low at 848¼. Settled at 874¼, down 4½ cents in November. Soybean futures for the day, 883¼, the high, the low at 47. Settlement price at 874, down 4¼. Once again, that November contract settled at 874, down 4¼, and the low on that day at 847½. December bean meal futures, a 258.50 settlement price, down $2.30 with a high of 262.50, a low at 256. January bean meal, 257.70, a settlement price there, $1.40 higher. December soybean oil, 31.46, the high, the low at 30.02, settlement price at 31.10, down 36 for the day. And the January futures, 31.67, the high, the low at 30.15, settlement price at 30.92. And that January bean oil finished down 80 cents. Recapping the numbers once again, futures in the wheat pit were higher. Nearby contract gained 15½ cents, but the rest of those contracts up about 4 to 5 cents. Corn, the big winner for the day, up anywhere between 16 and the very far deferred September 2010 contract. to most of the contracts being up about 22, 23 cents for the afternoon. Beans were the loser, down 2 to 4 cents in the nearby. The FAR deferreds in 2010 were up about 3.5 cents on the afternoon. During the closing market report today, we'll talk with Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management Commodities Incorporated out of Lafayette, Indiana. And then don't forget to tune in for Commodity Week. That airs tomorrow morning, twice actually on this station at 6:30, I believe, and 11:30, actually 6 o'clock and 11:30. You can pick up Commodity Week. Our panelists in studio, a good one, Paul Cooley, Wayne Nelson, and Dan Zwicker, all in studio this week for Commodity Week, so be sure you tune in for that one. I'll be back in just about 10 minutes now with the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now let's take a look at how the livestock contracts fare today in Chicago. Lower day today for cattle and lean hogs. December live cattle, the high 84.45, the low 83.10, the settlement 83.32.5, that down 115. February 83.75, the high 82.40, the low 82.80, the settlement, that down 102.5. April 85.70, the high 84.30, the low 84.95, the settlement, that down 72.5. And June live cattle, 82.30, the high, the low 80.95, the settlement 81.75. Down 60. January feeder cattle, 87.40, the high, 86.20, the low, 87.17.5, the settlement, that down 42.5. March, 86.90, the high, 85.70, the low, the settlement, 86.45, down 87.5. April, 87.55, the high, 86.75, the low, the settlement, 87.12.5, that down 72.5. May feeder cattle, 89 even, the high, 87.80, the low, 88.75, the settlement, that down 62.5. December lean hogs, 56.25, the high, 56 even, the low, 56.02.5, the settlement, that down 12.5. February, 62.70, the high, 61.95, the low, the settlement, 62.27.5, that down 10. April, 68.25, the high, 67.65, the low, the settlement 67.77.5, that down 7.5. May lean hogs finish on the upside today, up 30 cents, 75.75, the high, 74.90, the low, 75.75, the settlement. May lean hogs finishing up 30. February bellies, 82.35, the high, 80.80, the low, the settlement 81.20, that down 122.5. The Dow is up 41 at 86.06. The NASDAQ up 22 at 1530. The S&P 500 up a point at 875. Excuse me, the S&P 500 at 875. Oil, nearby month in New York, down 83 cents to 47.15.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Mahomet, Tuscola, and Danville, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, Ehud Barak is campaigning to be Israel's prime minister again. This time he's running negative ads about himself. Israelis in one TV spot say Ehud Barak is condescending, lacking feelings, and not nice. And that's the point. Candidate Ehud Barak tries to make his nastiness a plus. That story from Israel in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director this afternoon. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in northern and western Illinois and in northwestern Indiana, partly to mostly sunny. In eastern Illinois and southeastern Illinois and in west central and southwestern Indiana, becoming partly to mostly sunny. In eastern Indiana, cloudy with scattered snow showers. Highs ranging from 16 in far northern Illinois to 40 in the far south. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, lows ranging from 14 in northern Illinois.